And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Stop it!
What's in the box?
Disenfranchised by the modern comics industry, producer Paul Spataro, Dr. Bill Robinson, and Scott H. Gardner now
ply the time stream in a never-ending quest to rediscover and reconnect with that unique brand of fun and excitement that can only truly be found in good old-fashioned, randomly selected comic book back issues. Journey with them now. Back to the bins.
I got nowhere else to go!
I got nothing else.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a very special Back to the Bins. And it's very special because we've got the gang back together today for a short period of time. And the gang being myself, Mr. Scott H. Gardner.
Hello.
Hello. I guess H is for hello. We have Mr. David Pascarella.
How's it going?
It's going slow. I'm thinking that we got a lag here on when I say things and when I get an answer. But we also have the return, the successful return of Dr. Bill to the show. Welcome aboard.
Hi, everybody.
And there was much rejoicing.
Yay.
So there's been, it's been a little slow go getting Dr. Bill back, but we're thrilled to have him here, even though he tells us he's only got a limited time with us tonight. So we're going to talk a little bit with him before we get to our books. And the subject of today's show is the recent passing of comic, I'm going to say icon, Sal Buscema. Sal is, you know, died 2 days short of his 90th birthday. So, you know, he had a good run, as we say, but it's still sad to see him go. And my experience with Sal Buscema is I think he was always a good storyteller and a good draftsman. He would generally draw images that always presented the story very well. I think, you know, when we talk about salaries, when we talk about like athletes, they talk about the floor and the ceiling. And I think Sal's ceiling wasn't quite as high as some of the, you know, the ones we call icons, you know, the Jack Kirby and Neil Adams and John Romita and John Byrne. His ceiling wasn't as high as theirs. But I also think his floor was pretty high. I don't ever remember him coming out with a book that I thought was bad. Everything was at least good, and some of it was brought up a level. And I think because he was a good draftsman and because he was a good storyteller, I think to some extent the rise and fall was more dependent on who was inking him. And my personal favorite of his inkers was Klaus Janson, and I'm going to cover a book today where Klaus inked him.
Klaus?
And I think that inking was a perfect combination because I like Klaus Janson's inking on him more than his more famous works with John Romita Jr. or Frank Miller. So we'll go over that in a moment. But I guess everybody could give their experiences with Mr. Buscema. I never met him personally. I was never at a show that he was at, so I don't have anything like that to share.
I always... my most memorable cover, and I even remember where I finally found this book. I think it's Avengers 89. It's the cover with Mar-Vell on it. Looks like he's getting electrocuted, and it's like yes. the only good alien is, you know, and it was such a striking cover, you know, and he did a good stint on the Avengers in the 70s. I think started in like 70, 71. But the other thing and you know what? I might be getting confused with his brother. Doesn't Sal have the like when somebody's screaming or yelling, there's like that line of spittle that goes from the top and the bottom of the mouth? Or did they both do that?
No, that was more of a self thing.
Okay, because the first time I took notice of that was with the Hulk. And then later I think he did some issues of Thor, and there was a lot of things where Thor's fighting other trolls and such, and they've got the spittle line going, and I'm like, so yeah, it's sad that we've lost another great. And I'm out.
And Scott and Dave obviously have no opinions.
You know, I'm not one who really follows the creators as much as you guys. I only know the only works I'm familiar with, because Scott pointed them out, G.I. Joe 177, 182, and annual number one from the IDW run, which I have them all.
For me, he's a good example of how my tastes have changed and hopefully matured over time of, you know, being a comics fan and all, because I remember not being, pardon me, particularly enamored of his stuff as a kid. You know, not that I hated it. You know, he wasn't one of the ones I would look at and go, ew, you know, but it was just one of those ones I considered kind of workmanlike. And it wasn't until later, I tell you, the thing that really did turn me around with him was, when I completed my collection of ROM and then sat down to read it. Initially going into that series, that was one of the trepidations I had, was initially I didn't much care for the art, but over time I came to really love and appreciate his art on that series, and you know, would seek out other things by Sal Buscema. But the thing that I discovered, and I can't remember where I read it for the first time or like what age I was or whatever, but it's the issue that Paul's going to cover tonight, so I won't spoil what it is. But when I read that for the first time, I was so blown away by the art and that I was like, wow, why doesn't he look like this all the time? And it took me a while to realize it was because of the inker that he's paired with. I'm totally with Paul that I think Klaus Janson is actually his best inker. So I actually pulled up Mike's Amazing World the other night and was looking at their credits side by side to see how much they'd actually worked together. And sadly, it wasn't very much. Most of it happens in the Defenders, and there's a fair number of issues of Defenders where they worked together, and that stuff looks really, really good. But outside of Defenders, it's pretty scattershot, and it's not very many projects that they actually worked with together, which is kind of a shame, because, man, you put the two of them together, and it's fantastic stuff. It's right up there for me with, like, Colin and Janson working together. I really like their stuff a lot too. So yeah, that's what kind of turned me around on him. And now I look at his stuff and I'm really impressed with it, especially again, his Hulk. I never thought much of his Hulk as a kid, but looking back on it now, I'm like, he's kind of the definitive Hulk guy in a lot of ways, or at least like 70s Hulk, like 70s and 80s Hulk. I think he's kind of the guy. And yeah, I really like that stuff.
I originally, Herb Trimpe was my 70s Hulk guy, and we've discussed him in the past, and I don't really want to turn this into a Trimpe discussion, but Sal Buscema was more late 70s into the 80s on Hulk, and probably did just as many issues of it, so he has that. He also did a tremendous run on Spectacular Spider-Man. He had fingerprints like all over the Marvel Universe, really. If you look, you know, probably every long-running series he did at least a few issues of. I don't think there's anything that escaped his grasp. And I think he was a popular artist with management and with the inkers that he worked with. Because I think he did do such a, you know, we say it almost as an insult when we say, oh, he's workmanlike. But I mean it in the most complimentary of ways to say that he's workmanlike, because as I started to say, his storytelling always kind of got the point across. There was never a point where the images seemed convoluted or they seemed bogged down where the you know, the pacing of the story would lag because of what he did. I think, you know, he was one of these artists where, for the most part, you didn't have to read the word bubbles if you didn't want to, because his storytelling told the whole story. And then the word bubbles enhanced it, but they weren't necessary to just kind of get the gist of what was going on. And I think he was, as far as that goes, I think he was pretty much a master craftsman. I think, you know, his stories were always really well laid out in that regard. You know, when I was thinking of his stuff, I really got fixated on the Klaus Janson Defenders issues. In fact, I was going to bring one of them tonight until Scott pointed out to me that it's an issue we had already covered. So then I shifted over to this one that he suggested to me, which I think is a prime example of the beautiful art that he did, especially, you know, in combination with Janson. So I'm really happy with the issue I ended up with, which, you know, there's no point in being mysterious about it. It's Hulk number 227. Like I said, I was initially inclined to do Defenders because that was my favorite stuff by him, but this is every bit as good. I just think the difference between this and that is the Defenders had a little bit of a run of issues. I don't know, maybe 5, 6, 7 issues where that combination was together, and it really made an impression on me, whereas I don't think they stayed together much on the Hulk.
Was that the Elf with a Gun thing? Or am I thinking of a different
I think he drew some of those, but I don't think Janson inked him on those.
Ah, gotcha.
You know, the combination was only short-lived. But I wish, like Scott had said, I wish that they had done more together, because they were dynamite together. I think, you know, I think it's that Buscema would draw a really solid image, and then Janson's inks would add the mood to it. They'd be, you know, shadowy where it needed to be, or brighter where it needed to be. And it would really just kind of create that feeling of, you know, almost a cinematic feeling to it because of the way he would ink them. So, you know, I think we've gone over many, many times on this show where we've talked about pencils versus inks, and, you know, how the inker can ultimately really affect the issues. And I think that's where, you know, I think we were doing an issue of the Avengers, maybe one of the annuals or something, and we were pointing out some of the bad images in it until Scott went online and found the penciled pages for it. And you could see such a dramatic difference that the images that we saw colored, inked and colored for that matter, we weren't crazy about. But when he found the penciled images for us, it was like, oh my God, that's so much better. So, right. You know, these artists do rise and fall based on the inker that they're paired with. And, you know, it ranges from the inker totally torpedoing them and screwing them over to the inker, you know, rising the material or lifting the material to another level. And I think Sal's work at its worst with an inker that really didn't suit him would still be fairly good. And I think that goes to what I was saying about his floor wasn't that low. You know, his worst stuff is still pretty darn good. And then when you paired him with an inker who was, you know, exceptional for him. And I think to some extent, both of the issues we have, it's a quality inker, although I think Janson is far superior. Yes. But you could see it rise. It lifts the level up and it makes it, you know, exceptional. And I like to think, you know, in his wake, that we could talk about it, you know, his exceptional work.
I'm just looking at the list of everything he did. He really dabbled in everything across Marvel and even a little bit in DC, which I didn't realize. Man of Steel, 65 and 94, Superboy, Robin, Detective. Seems like more in the late 90s, early 2000s. Even Battlestar Galactica, he did a few?
Yeah.
I have that run.
Some of those, I think, are him and Janson together as well.
And I think one of the last series that he did as a regular was the Spider-Girl series.
Yeah.
And I don't have a lot of familiarity with that, but I was going to say, Scott, I think you do. And I'd just wonder, you know, what you thought of the art was in those.
Sort of. I just recently acquired What If number 105, which is her first appearance. So now I have every appearance of Spider-Girl. Have I read them? Nope. They're still on the to-read pile. But I'm looking forward to going into them because I see where he is being utilized in an inker capacity mostly with the Spider-Girl stuff. So I'm curious how that would look because it's Ron Frenz, who's one of my absolute favorite artists, being inked by Sal Buscema. So I'm very curious to see what the final product is on that stuff. I will get to it eventually because that's rather high on my want to read list, especially now that I finally have, you know, the complete run. So
I have a hard out. Be careful. No, Dave, not
put that shit away.
Oh, I got confused.
I was gonna say thankfully Bill's camera is off.
So, yeah, exactly. So I will be getting back with you guys more often once I get a new setup in my garage. I didn't know I could get on the phone, you know, to just jump in. And so I'll be around more often.
Great.
And I'll have my setup done soon.
We look forward to having you more often, Dr. Bill.
And we could finish the Avengers stuff. Keep going with that.
Yeah, we got to at least get through that Kang initiative.
Yeah, I know.
You and me, urban legend, soon. We got to make it happen.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, that guy keeps advertising tons and tons and tons of stuff. And I went there. I went there a while back, and it was like he just keeps changing everything.
I know.
Yeah, well, the last time when I went with you, Bill, when did we go? Was it like September maybe?
It was November, I think. Early November.
Oh, November. And it was like, oh, there's rooms here that weren't here before. He just keeps expanding.
Yeah. Yep. So, all right.
And then he had the one room, just finished the thought, he had the one room that was like adults only. So, you think of like the rooms in the video stores where they had all the porn, which it wasn't that at all. But that's like you almost feel dirty walking into those rooms. And it was just, you know, more mature stories, but it wasn't anything that had to do with, you know, nothing untoward.
Yeah. You go from there, then you go to the kids' room, and you're like, man, I feel dirty. So, all right. I will talk to you guys later.
Thanks for coming on with us, and we'll look forward to having you on again soon, or having you become a regular again soon.
All right. Bye, listeners. See ya.
Okay, so we have our two books that we are covering. Scott, yours predates mine by a couple of months.
All right.
Actually, by about a year and a half. So you might as well go first.
All right. So you got to forgive me, listeners. I do not have a pre-canned synopsis for this. So this is going to be old-fashioned, off-the-cuff style. So let's see how we do here. Hopefully this won't turn into a Dr. Bill synopsis. But here we go.
Well, this is going to be interesting because we are truly going old school. Because I also do not have a pre-canned synopsis, and I'm going to go off the cuff. This is
right now.
We've been airing the classic episodes every other week, and we're doing our synopsises in the classic bins episode style.
All right, so for my selection for tonight, and I'll get into why I picked this book a little bit later after we get everything synopsized and all, we have Marvel 2-in-1, number 24. This is a cover dated February 1977, was actually on sale on the stands, according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, on November 2nd, 1976, for a whopping 30 cents. penciler on the cover of this is Ron Wilson, inked by Joe Sinnott, and it is The Thing and Black Goliath, and it's a pretty cool cover on this one. We'll get into that here in just a second, what's on the cover. Title of this story is Does Anyone Remember ... The Hijacker? It was written by Bill Mantlo. Actually, you know what? I think the credits are different inside, because doesn't it say, yeah, Bill Mantlo and Jim Shooter are credited with story in the actual issue. Mike's Amazing World just credits Bill Mantlo. The issue says Bill Mantlo and Jim Shooter, story. Sal Buscema and Pablo Marcus on the pictures. Pablo Marcus as the inker on this one. And that's as far as we need to go on the credits on this. Cover on this is really cool, though. It's The Thing, and he is struggling to carry Black Goliath, who is in his Goliath form, so he's supersized, and he's unconscious. There's this green, wispy gas all around. It almost looks like it would glow in the dark or something. I love the colors on it. It's like neon green. And they're being pursued by this hijacker and his deadly murder machine. And The Thing is thinking to himself, blasted gas KO'd Goliath. Now it's getting to me. But if I fall, them spiked treads will cream us both. So it's a pretty cool cover. All right. So as we start this story, we see in the foreground, we've got Bill Foster, who's a scientist working at one of Stark's labs. And he is monitoring The Thing, who is in this special chamber. He's wearing this special suit that recreates the conditions of the surface of the planet Venus. And The Thing is basically bitching about, you know, he's been loaned to them by Reed Richards of the Fantastic Four for these experiments. You get the sense kind of against his will, or, you know, begrudgingly, he's helping them out with all this stuff. But he's just done, and he wants out of The Thing. So there's a little bit of comedy that ensues. Tony Stark buzzes in on the monitor, and we get a little back and forth with The Thing and Foster and the other workers in the lab and everything. We cut to outside the facility where a guard is just kind of lightly dozing and kind of bored in his job, essentially. And all of a sudden he turns and goes, no, no. So we don't know what's going on. We cut back to the lab. A little bit more going on with Foster and monitoring The Thing and everything. They're about ready to bring him out of the chamber when all of a sudden gas is launched into the room and it starts knocking everybody out that's in the room. And The Thing is witnessing this from inside the chamber. He wants to bust out and go help them, but he realizes that if he busts out of the chamber, he's going to release the deadly atmosphere from inside the simulation of, again, the planet Venus, into the chamber, which would kill everybody. So he can't escape. Foster manages to fight off unconsciousness and gets to a panel where he's able to release the airlock, essentially. So now The Thing is in the inner part of the airlock and the door is closed behind him. But Foster passes out, so The Thing just smashes through the other airlock, busting into the room, so he's no longer at risk of, you know, poisoning everybody that's in that room. He comes in, he grabs Foster and all the scientists and carries them out of the room, rips out of the outfit that he was in, and he's intent to go track down the guy that was responsible for this. The guy that was responsible was, of course, the villain that was, you know, advertised right there on the cover, The Hijacker. This dude looks flat ridiculous. Think Marty when he was disguised as Darth Vader from the planet Vulcan, if he was a tubby bastard. And that's essentially what you've got here with the Hijacker. He just looks completely silly. He's just this big tubby guy with a goofy looking gas mask and like a bio suit. He just looks really silly. So this thing charges off after the hijacker and leaves Bill Foster by himself. Bill Foster climbs to his feet and puts on his mask. And as he's running towards us, the reader, we see him suddenly gain size and stature, and he becomes the hero Black Goliath, which is pretty cool. And so the hijacker is making his way through the facility. He uses his nuclear flame device to go into basically a weapons vault, like a weapons cache. He's there to steal all these prototype weapons and everything from this vault, basically selling the secrets of Tony Stark's weapon inventions is his whole scheme here. And we basically get the Thing and Black Goliath having to team up to stop him is essentially what goes on. So there's a lot of run, smash, fight, that sort of thing. Really great, great splash panel on page 23 as the hijacker takes over the what he calls his crime tank, essentially the thing that we saw on the cover, the big tank thing with the spiky treads, and he's intent to run them down with the machine. And Thing and Black Goliath try their best to stop the tank, but it proves stronger than either one of them. So the Thing lets the machine go over top of him and then busts into it from underneath. And that's how they're able to capture the hijacker. The issue ends with the Thing ripping the gas helmet off of the hijacker. And then he flicks his finger, is all he has to do, kind of old school Superman style. Just flicks his finger and knocks the guy for a loop. And that's pretty much the end of it. And I love this issue. It's very simple. It's very basic. There's not a lot of depth to it, but I just get a kick out of this particular issue. This one to me, as soon as I open it up and see that splash page, this is an old friend, because I had an old coverless copy of this from when I was a kid, when I was first getting into comics, first starting to collect comics. And I, of course, knew who the Thing was. I had no clue who Black Goliath was. So this was my introduction to this character. And I've always had a soft spot for Black Goliath just because of this issue. I thought he was cool. I still think he's cool. His outfit.
Right until the clone Thor threw his hammer through his chest and killed him.
I know. Did he ever recover? Did he ever come back? Or is he still dead?
Not that I'm aware of. I think he's still dead.
That's a shame. I liked him. His outfit's cool because it reminds me of Nomad when Cap was Nomad, the man without a country, for a while. It's essentially the same costume, but he's got this weird open midriff thing, and I don't know what that's all about. That looks kind of strange. But otherwise,
it's an abs window.
It was the 70s. It's like one of the village people.
Yeah, he's one of these characters that I always enjoyed when I found out that for years before he became a superhero, he was a supporting character of sorts. I mean, he wasn't around all the time, but he was first introduced in the somewhere in the between 20 and 30 of the Avengers. And you know, he was a scientist, and then eventually he developed the ability to grow, you know, with Hank's formula, because he worked with Hank to help cure Hank, which they mention in this issue. It's part of the you know, in I don't remember if it's in the dialogue or if it's in a flashback or whatever. This issue, though, just to focus a little bit on the art, since we did you know, since it was picked because it's a Buscema issue, I think it's a prime example of what I was saying, where if you took this issue and just paged through it without reading a word in it, you kind of got a good feeling for what the story was. I don't think you needed to actually read the word balloons. I do think for the most part they added to it. But then there's one sequence, the sequence when he's actually growing, which I think is really, really well drawn, as you mentioned. But, you know, his dialogue there just seemed so silly that he'd be saying these things as he's running along. I just, as I was reading it, I was thinking, wouldn't it be just so much better if these were just, you know, boxes of information that they weren't actually being said. Because people don't say that. People don't grow and then say, and I'm going to become the man known as Black Goliath. It's like, no, you don't do that. Especially when you're in a room alone. I mean, and this was a common mistake among Marvel artists. I mean, Bill Mantlo is one of the best writers, so I can't criticize his writing at all. But, you know, they used to do that a lot where they, you know, they would be introducing themselves. And that's why I'm the man known as fill in the blank.
You know, it's like Harvey Korman in Blazing Saddles monologuing.
Yes, much like Harvey Korman.
What am I telling Headley. You?
I love it, though. I do. I, as corny as it may be and unrealistic or whatever, I don't know. To me, it's just, this is Marvel Comics.
You want to know what I liked about it? I liked, and I haven't read any of these, I kind of figured out who he was because I knew who the original Goliath was, that they're meeting for the first time. And there's not a fight, and neither one is like a jerk about it.
Right.
You know, Black Goliath doesn't have an ego, you know, something along the lines of Green Arrow's type of personality.
Right.
And Ben Grimm is the experienced guy. And, oh, go, you know, good, you're here to help me out. You know, it wasn't like, oh, you know, you're the newbie. You don't understand anything. So it was, I thought that was
on the other hand. On the other hand, he knows Bill Forster. He was just in a room with Bill Forster.
I was going to say something about that too. Now this guy comes in
wearing a half mask, and he can't tell that it's the same guy.
Well, I am a fan of Clark Kent, so
I would take it as he probably does, and out of respect, he's just not mentioning it. You know, he's not making a big deal out of it.
We could have had six issues of him denying that he's Bill Forster.
I just think of the Saturday Night Live episode with where they had Superman and he's walking around and everybody in the room knows that Clark Kent is Superman, but they're like just humoring him and like laughing behind his back. I mean, while he's walking around like the cape is sticking out of the back of his pants and stuff. Or to relate it to real comics, there was in the early issues of Strange Tales, Johnny Storm thought he had a secret identity, but he didn't. Like, everybody knew Johnny Storm was the Human Torch, but he didn't realize that everybody knew it. So he tried to like work as his secret identity, which I think was Stan writing him as having a secret identity and realized this is silly. He doesn't have one, and he had to just kind of backtrack on it. But yeah, I can't see how he wouldn't recognize him. But this is your typical team up series fun issue. You know, right. it's not going to be anything that's going to affect great continuity. It's kind of cool that they thought to bring back, you know, a villain that was from the very early days of Marvel. You know, it hadn't been seen since. So I always like when they do that, even when they're lame villains like this.
He's a Mort.
And the story is just, you know, oh, he's definitely a Mort. But he manages to get them on the back of their feet somehow, that they're thrown off by him at first. And if Forster hadn't been wise enough to stay low and cover his mouth to clear the gas out, that he would have gotten away with it if not for you meddling kids.
Hijacker and his tank and those exploratory vehicles in the warehouse, they remind me of that issue of Star Wars, Droid World.
Yeah. The
40s, you know, after 45, I think. I'm not sure the exact number.
Yeah. No, I can see that.
Going to the artwork again, page 23, which is a huge, you know, it's a splash of the crime tank coming at the two of them. To me, is an example of how well Buscema could lay out a page, because this is not a typical angle. You know, the Thing and Black Goliath are down at the bottom. They're they're not the focus of the page. The crime tank is, and yet it's a beautiful image. And when you start to like look at it closely, it's really well drawn.
Mm-hmm. I love the perspective on it. It really looks like it's coming right at you.
Yeah.
It's very cool.
It's got kind of that I forget what they call the angle, what do you call it, like a Dutch angle.
Right. Yeah.
It shows you what he did as far as the layouts on this thing. You know, some really, really nice work. I don't think, again, as I mentioned, I don't think Marcos is as good as Jansen, but he's really solid. It almost appears to me like George Perezian in the way it's presented in some of the panels.
Yeah.
I could see that.
I think he was often paired with Perez. I don't know if that was during this time or not, but I want to say they did work together quite a bit, didn't they? And at least in some early Perez stuff, I think.
I'm not sure. Maybe. But, you know, really well done. Is the cover also Buscema?
No.
No, it's covers
Ron Wilson and Joe Sinnott.
Really? Because on the... on the Marvel Wiki page, it says Gil Kane and Frank Giacoya.
Does it? That's interesting. Yeah. Let me pull the cover back up and see if it's signed. You know, now that you say that, Black Goliath in the face does look like Gil Kane to me. Now that you say that's funny.
Where did you get, was that from Mike's Amazing World?
Yeah, Mike's Amazing World has it credited as Ron Wilson and Joe Sinnott. But yeah, you know, now that you say Gil Kane, I can kind of see some Gil Kane in there. It could be.
Yeah, I can, as well, but I'm not 100% sure. I couldn't swear to it. I could tell you that's what I think.
Yeah, I don't see a signature anywhere. That's interesting.
Any other commentary on this one?
I've always dug this issue. Like you say, it's nothing earth shattering. It doesn't, you know, necessarily lend anything to the overall continuity or narrative or whatever. I mean, it's an easily forgotten tale, but I've always gotten the biggest kick out of it just because it's just fun. It's just old school team up fun comics. And I miss stuff like this, you know?
That's what you need sometimes. Not everything is a world shattering.
Exactly. It's just, you know, it's fun. It's throwaway. And, you know, you read it for 20 minutes or whatever, and you have a good time, and then you move on to the next thing. And that's kind of what this one is. But I really like it. I respect the craftsmanship that goes into it. Because I really like the Thing, and I like when he's really used to good effect with, you know, showcasing his powers and his intelligence and everything. And I feel like this issue really does that. He's used very dynamically, and I love some of the shots of him, you know, really unleashing with his powers, you know, especially where what page is it here? There's a page where he grabs something. Yeah, this big, I don't know what it's supposed to be, like a big pipe or something at the bottom of page 26. I love that. You know, the whole body language behind it of him, you know, just trying to smash the tank by hitting it with heavier and heavier things. I love that. He's, you know, he's a very basic kind of guy. You know, he's not a deep thinker like Reed Richards or what. He's just, well, let me just smash this thing. You know, that's how he deals with the, you know, the super threats. And I love that. You know, it's basic, but it's very cool.
Agreed.
He was smart enough to go for the underbelly.
Yep.
Yep. Yeah. Do some grades on this one?
Sure. Let's see, cover on this one. I really like the cover. I, you know, now that we have this mystery of who exactly did the cover, I still really like the cover. I think the cover is very cool. I think I will go a solid B plus on the cover. I think it's a pretty good cover. I really do dig that one. The story, it's fun. I have no quibbles with the story. It's just, you know, it's just good, clean fun. Like I say, you know, it doesn't change your world or anything, but it's a fun and entertaining tale. And again, for me, it introduced me to this character of Black Goliath, who, you know, now I know who he is. I don't know that I've still really ever read a hell of a lot of Black Goliath. I know he had a short-lived series of his own, which I assume was going on concurrently with his appearance here. But yeah, I thought that part of it was cool. So story-wise, I'll say an A on the story. That, you know, story's just fine. I don't have any problems with it or what. Art. I think the art's really, really good on this. I think that Buscema and Marcus are an interesting pairing. Overall, I think they meld together fairly well, although I do feel like their styles are... I think they complement each other well, but I think they do also have very disparate styles that you wouldn't necessarily, you know, they wouldn't be the first people I would think to kind of mash together, because I do think their styles are quite dissimilar from each other, but here they meld together pretty well. So art wise on this, I think I would go an A on the art. I think it's a very, very well drawn and well illustrated issue. If I had any quibbles at all about the art, is that, I think I was going to say it might be the inking, but actually I think a lot of it might come down to the coloring, which doesn't have anything to do with, either of the artists on this, but some of the coloring I think is a little bit weird and doesn't necessarily help the art in some instances, but overall, I think it's a pretty dynamic looking book. So overall grade on this, I will say an A- as an overall grade. I think it's a pretty darn good book. It's just a lot of fun.
I'd be right there with you. The cover, you know, I looked at this cover, not being a Marvel person, and the first two things that popped into my head was, oh my God, it's Kryptonite gas.
Yeah.
And two, between Goliath's big yellow gloves and those big yellow missiles on the tank, Green Lantern better stay the hell out of this book. But it's a fun cover. It's just, it's that 70s, there's a lot of that 1970s tech in it, where either, you know, droids or Battlestar Galactica, stuff like that, stuff you'd see in those books. But the, I'm with you right there with the cover. The cover to me is a solid B+. The story's fun. I kind of felt, like I said, it zigged when a lot of books, particularly I think in the 70s, zagged with the whole Forster not having a chip on his shoulder. So I really enjoyed it. It was just, you know, a fun little story, which I would give a solid A. The art, I would give that's a solid B+. I give this book an overall grade of A-2. I'm right there with you.
I like the cover a lot. I think, it's telling you what's in the story, but it's giving you a really good image. I'm gonna say a B+ on the cover. I think it's really solid. It's not quite iconic, not quite something that I need to hang up in my home, but still really good. The interior artwork, as I said, from the Buscema point of view, I think it's top notch. I think the inking gives it more of a slick feel, which is very different from what we're going to look at in the next issue. But again, like I said, it almost reminds me of Perez type stuff. So it's showing you, I think, how Buscema could be inked by two different, very different artists and still come up with a top-notch work, because his, you know, the basis that he's giving them to work with is so solid to begin with. So I'm going to say I'm going to say a solid B plus on the art. I think it's really, really good. At some points, the art, the inking almost, like I already said, it's Perezian, but at some points it also reminds me a little bit of Bob Layton as far as the inking goes. So, you know, it's, and the, you know, these are top names. This is not, certainly, you know, not an insult to be compared to these people. The story is just stupid fun, you know, team up book fun. And did I actually give a grade to the interior art? I don't even know. I'm going to say an A on the interior art. I think it's really good. And the story is just, like I said, stupid fun. So it's a B plus on the story. And overall, I'm going to give the book an A minus. I think it's really just an enjoyable read on every level. Fantastic. So to follow that up,
it's funny Scott, you mentioned my book. I was just going to say, ahead. It's funny you mentioned Joe Staten, because a book that I strongly considered bringing is, pardon me, Incredible Hulk number 206, which is the one where the Hulk goes on his rampage right after Jor-El had died. It's that one they used right on like the notebooks and stuff when Marvel did like those, like the Trapper Keepers and all that stuff, if you know the one I'm talking about. Right. But he's inked, Sal Buscema is inked on that one by Joe Staten, and it's fantastic. Their stuff looks really good together.
I didn't remember actually mentioning Joe Staten, but okay. Yeah, I don't disagree. I don't recall saying his name at all. Anyway, it could just be old age.
The Alzheimer's disease podcast.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mentioned earlier, I had picked an issue of The Defenders because that was some of my favorite Sal Buscema work. But then Scott pointed out that we had already done that book. So he said, you might want to consider this one. And I got to tell you, Scott, thank you for suggesting this book, because you really suggested a top-notch one. It's Hulk number 227, which was released on June 20th of 1978 and has a cover date of September of 1978. And the cover is not by Buscema. It's by Herb Trimpe and Joe Rubinstein. And it is kind of a poster image, but it also gives us what we get inside. And it's got the Hulk, and he's holding an unconscious Bruce Banner and ready to crush him. And behind him are the original Avengers with Iron Man, Wasp, Giant Man, and Thor. I guess it's the issue 2 Avengers, because issue 1 he was Ant-Man. Anyway, really solid image. But when the story opens, and it is called The Monsters Analyst, and it is written by Roger Stern, and it says with an assist by Peter Gillis. It's illustrated by Sal Buscema and Klaus Janson, lettered by John Costanza, colored by Glynis Ween, and supervised by Bob Hall and Jim Shooter. It opens with the Hulk on a metal couch, and he's being psychoanalyzed by Leonard Sampson. And while this is going on, they're in a secure facility or secure area, and they're being overseen by Jim Ross, a magician whose name I forget. It's like Kropotnik or something silly like that. Clay Quatermain and some other dude. And it turns out what happened is that Samson previously had a while back done some psychoanalyzation of Bruce Banner. And now he wants to try and probe the mind of the Hulk, because he believes they are truly one personality, and that the Hulk needs to accept that Bruce Banner is his, you know, his alter ego effectively. So he wants to try and psychoanalyze him, and he's got some heavy equipment that's going to allow him to go into a dreamscape with him. And he administers a drug to Bruce to have him change to the Hulk, but have him do so without being in his angry mode. So he's laying on this metal couch, which has got to be one of the most uncomfortable looking things I've ever seen in my life. And he put some electrodes on his head so that he can go into this dreamscape that we talked about. And then he has his own helmet on, and it initially converts to the same shape as the couch, only now it's a brick area, and they're in like a wooded area, and there's a house that they go to, which is apparently Bruce's childhood home, where peeking through the window, excuse me, Bruce touches a radiator and burns himself, which the Hulk actually feels the burning and then destroys the house. Then we cut to Bruce in science class, where he makes a mistake and is yelled at by Mr. Woodman. And I assume Mr. Woodman is a tribute to the character of Mr. Woodman from Welcome Back, Kotter.
God, I forgot about it.
And he ends up, when Mr. Woodman yells at him, he slaps his hands together and creates some havoc there. So the next thing they go to is the area where the Hulk was created, with Rick Jones sitting in a car playing his harmonica, Bruce Banner running over, and the gamma bomb goes off. And that's where things kind of go awry for Leonard Sampson, because we have a beautiful splash page of the Hulk holding Bruce Banner by his lapel way up in the air and ready to pulverize him. So things are not going exactly the way he planned, and he's ready to actually hit Rick when he's then confronted by the Avengers. But it's an interesting combination of the Avengers, because it's Thor and the Wasp, but then we have two different versions of Iron Man, his golden armor, and then his next version, I guess the Mach 2, or Mach 3, whatever it is. And we also have Ant-Man and Giant Man. So he's first attacked by Thor, and the Hulk's belief is Thor's power is all contained within his hammer, and he grabs the hammer and crushes it, at which point Thor becomes an empty shell, and he throws him where Leonard Sampson catches him and puts him on the ground. He takes one Iron Man and he uses him to smash the other, exposing them as empty shells, which is how the Hulk perceives them. He then grabs the Ant-Man and the Wasp and actually throws them at Giant Man. And it's then revealed, because Leonard's still trying to get through to him, and it's revealed that he has a tough time letting anybody in, because everyone he feels close to dies. And we see Jarella and Crackerjack something, I don't even remember what his name was, and three other characters, and I'm trying to remember, I think one is from Tyrannus, and one is, I don't even know who the other ones are, to be honest with you. And that's his problem, is that everyone dies, and then he's confronted again by Bruce Banner, and the two of them rear back and throw a punch at each other, Rocky III style, where they both landed at the same time, and at that point, Leonard is taken out of the psychoanalyst position, and he gets information that they overdosed the Hulk with the gamma medication, and he's going to remain the Hulk for at least a week. And it says, next bad moon on the rise. I think the art in this is absolutely gorgeous. Yes. You know, the story, you know, it's on both levels. This one is a top-notch issue, to be honest with you. I think the art is absolutely gorgeous, and I think the story is getting into stuff that eventually Peter David built upon. And I don't want to put down Peter David's work, because I think he did great stuff, but it shows you where these were some ideas that were in play before he got to the book, about the different personalities and how they, you know, how they were influenced by past events, and you know, the multiple personality syndrome that was explored by David is starting to get explored here, and I think it just gives you like a lot to think about as you're reading this, And it lays the groundwork for many stories to come.
I love this issue. Absolutely love this issue. You know, Roger Stern's my all-time favorite comic book writer. And this is the kind of issue that illustrates why right here, because he's really getting into the characters. That's what he's best at, is really knowing and understanding these characters and what makes them tick and bringing that to the forefront for the reader. And I really like this whole thing. And you're right, you know, Peter David would get a lot of mileage out of this. And I've always wondered if he was ever on record anywhere, you know, acknowledging this issue, that maybe this issue had been a big influence on him, you know, when he was younger or anything like that. I'm not aware of anything like that, but, you know, clearly he was, you know, either influenced by this and running with this, or at least thinking along the same lines. But I love this issue top to bottom. And I wish I could remember when exactly I discovered this issue. I had to have been a kid, though, because I remember getting to the end of this. And to me, the last panel always had like a built-in like dun 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 sound effect with it, because it's, you know, where Samson says, Clay, he'll remain the Hulk for at least a week. And the shot of the Hulk, because of the way it's printed on this old school, you know, newsprint type paper, to me, it's open to interpretation, because if you look at the Hulk's eyes, I see it three different ways here. Either his eyelids are closed, or he kind of looks like he's giving a sinister, like, side glance towards Samson, like he's thinking something like, I'm going to be the Hulk for a week and I'm going to cause some shit. Or the other eye kind of looks like he might be just staring blankly straight ahead. So it's hard to tell. It's a combination of both the dark inks and the limitations of the paper of the time. It leaves a lot of room for interpretation, but I like the one of the Hulk has kind of a sinister look on his face, like he's thinking, like, you know, something sinister is going on there. I like that. And for years, I wanted the next issue so bad. I'm like, oh, something's got to be awesome in the next issue. Spoiler. And the next issue is just kind of a standard issue of the Hulk, unfortunately. It's where he battles Moonstone. It's good, but this setup's not really paid off, unfortunately. But yeah, I agree with you. I think not only is the story fantastic in this, but man, the art. I mean, seldom, in my opinion, now granted, I've not read every single Sal Buscema story out there, but seldom did his art look better than right here in this issue, inked by Klaus Janson. That splash on page 17, where it's revealed that the Gamma Bomb has unleashed the Hulk, but Banner's still there so that he can actually get a hold of him. I love that, because the Hulk is saying, at last, Hulk has puny Banner where he's always wanted him. Now Hulk will smash. I love that. And he's just huge. He's muscular. And you feel the danger, like he is going to just pummel puny Banner. And it's a great, great shot.
No, this was a great issue. You know, I have to just get my humor out of the way. On page 2, not familiar with these characters, I saw the guy who kind of looks like Doctor Strange, and I went, what happened to him? Did he put on weight? I had no idea who that was. But I found this story to be rather deep for the time.
Yeah.
You know, it played into that whole psychoanalyzing craze of the 70s. Everybody's in therapy, laying on the couch. But it kind of reveals, you know, all the anger built up in Bruce Banner over the years, where he could do nothing about it.
Right.
And it's almost like I felt, you know, the Hulk has all this rage against Banner for possibly not doing anything about it. You know what right. I mean? Being the doormat, never saying anything, never having the nerve to deal with it. And now it's all going to come out. I thought it was fantastic. Of course, you know, the scene where Bruce burns himself on the radiator. I thought, how many people even know what this thing is today?
Right. I like that the expression on the child after he's been burned is essentially the same expression on the Hulk in that fifth panel, because I've always looked at the Hulk as like he is, especially this iteration of the Hulk, is childlike. He has a childlike mentality and his mood swings are very childlike as well. He can be kind of docile one moment and just completely maniacal the next, in kind of a childlike way. And I like that.
But look at the page 11 there. The panel where the experiment blows up. Look at the positioning of Bruce's face, particularly his mouth. It mirrors the Hulk in the next one.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. One thing occurred to me, though, in this is that a big deal is made about this experimental drug in this, this experimental thing that Samson is trying with releasing the Hulk, but keeping him docile so that he can, you know, do this whole psychoanalysis and everything. It's really interesting in this title, but it's also, to me, it seems a little inconsistent in the sense that I always thought The Defenders was kind of a weird book because the Hulk, you know, again, you know, this book ends with him saying, you know, he's going to be the Hulk for at least a week. But wasn't he the Hulk pretty much all the time in The Defenders? He very rarely ever changed back to Bruce Banner in The Defenders. So he was the Hulk pretty much all the time. And there was a lot of times where he was the Hulk, but they weren't fighting anybody. So he was kind of docile. Like they'd be sitting around like eating dinner or something and the Hulk would just be the Hulk. So I always thought that was kind of weird. I mean, you know, the whole gimmick was supposed to be he becomes the Hulk under stress. And then when he, you know, he calms down and his, you know, pulse returns to normal, he converts back to Banner. But clearly in The Defenders, that wasn't always the case because he would just hang out as the Hulk. So was there ever any explanation given to that?
No. I think they just I think it was just really a convenience thing.
Right.
They rarely had him turn back to Bruce Banner when he was in the company of the Defenders. I don't remember it happening very often at all.
Right.
So the next issue, he's going to the movies and he's at Coney Island.
He's riding the cyclone. I think if they felt the need to address that, they'd give you some explanation, like, you know, Doctor Strange did something to, you know, to affect him physically to maintain that that persona.
That's what I'm thinking.
So, you know, one way or the other, I'm sure they could explain it away. I was just going to say, this was just a great read. I really enjoyed this. And I wanted to touch on, I mentioned the Friends of the Hulk Who Died. And on the Marvel Wiki page, they give you a breakdown. First one is Crackerjack Jackson, who met the Hulk and died during a battle with Hammer and Anvil in Incredible Hulk 182, which, just as an aside, is an expensive issue because it's got the flashback to the first appearance of Wolverine. The unnamed Russian scientist befriended the Hulk in Tales to Astonish number 65 and sacrificed his life to protect him in Tales to Astonish 66. Then they have Phileas Omen, first met the Hulk in Incredible Hulk 164, when the Hulk helped Omen get to the surface world The lack of pressure caused Omen's body to literally explode in Hulk 165. I think he was an underwater being. The Hulk befriended Mogul in Incredible Hulk 127. In that same issue, the Hulk destroyed Mogul when he discovered that he was a robot. Lastly, the Hulk met and fell in love with Jarella in Incredible Hulk 140. She eventually sacrificed her life to save a young boy endangered during a battle with the Hulk in Incredible Hulk 205. So those were the friends that are all shown in that one panel.
Yeah. I like Jarella. I liked her a lot.
I thought she was a very interesting character that they didn't need to kill off as quickly as they did, because I think there was uncharted ground that they could have played with a little bit. And if you needed to kill her off because you couldn't, you know, because you can never have the Hulk be totally happy, I think they could have waited another 30 or 40 issues and really just explored their relationship some.
I agree. Yeah. There was more mileage to be had with her. That's for sure. Yeah. I think this might have been my introduction to Doc Samson. I can't quite remember, but that's kind of tickling my brain that this might be where I saw him for the first time. And I've always liked his character. I always thought he was pretty cool. I like that over time he kind of became a noble character. In reading through early issues of the Hulk not long ago, I found he was kind of a dick when he first came along, but he became a more noble character. And if this was where I discovered him, then, you know, there was no signs of that dickishness by the time you get to this iteration of him.
He was dick free.
This man has no dick.
That's what I heard.
We've kind of gone through my notes, other than just to say, once again, I think the artwork in this is amazing. I think it's top notch. It's the best combination of artist and or it's as good of a combination of artist and inker as I could come up with.
Agreed.
And I'm just going to point to page 6, where it starts off, he's Bruce Banner, and then he converts to the Hulk, and Samson puts the electrodes on his head, and then it cuts to a long shot. And just the shadowing on that page, I think, just lends an atmosphere to it that, again, the pencils are beautiful, but it just enriches them by creating that atmosphere. And I just think it's great.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, there's some really nice use of Zipitone on that sixth panel. That looks really, really good.
And I also just, you know, to touch a little bit more on the story, I love the way it's presented from the Hulk's perception. And again, you know, as you said, kind of the simple childlike perception. So Iron Man, there's two different Iron Mans, and they're both empty shells. There's nothing inside of them. There's no man inside of them. And then you have, you know, his take on Rick Jones and what he's doing. And there's just so much there. And again, I think it laid the groundwork for, I don't even know how many issues Peter David did. But he explored the multiple personalities and the perception and the different ways that the Hulk would present. Just great stuff. And this is, I think, what gave him the start. This is the foundation of it.
Right.
So, any more notes?
That's all I got. I think it's fantastic. I really do.
So yeah, I think for me. And I'm going to say the cover, which is by Trimpy, who is he's the artist I most commonly associate with the Hulk. And I have a soft spot for Trimpy, and having met him on one occasion and had an extensive conversation with him, I really respect the man. I mourned his passing. I think it is a very, very good cover. I think it's only negative I can give you is it's not quite up to the level of the interior art. It's probably very close to it, but it doesn't quite reach it. It is pretty much a poster image, and it's well done. I'm going to say the cover is an A, but the interior art is an A+. So that's the only negative I can give you is it's not as good as the interior art. There's things about the positioning of the Hulk that I'm not totally thrilled with, but I also think it just creates a dynamism to the, you know, it makes him feel like he's a character in motion almost. And that, you know, somehow you freeze framed him instead of just take, you know, instead of them posing. The interior art is an A+. I think this is up there with some of the best artwork I've ever seen. And the story, I think the story is also an A+, because it's just giving you again, levels to these characters that you didn't, or to this character at least, that you didn't have before. And it's really just giving so much depth to things. And it's also well presented in Samson's reaction to what's going on. A+ on the story, A+ on the artwork, A on the cover, A+ overall.
I'll be really quick. I agree with you on the story. I agree with you on the interior art. But as far as the cover, I don't think the A+ for me on the interior art detracts from the A+ of the cover. I really like the cover too. So I would say A+ across the board.
Yeah, I'm going to go A+ as well with the acknowledgement. The cover to me is the weak point. I honestly, I don't much care for the cover, but I think this is such a fantastic book. I'm going to still give it an overall A+ because, you know, it makes up for the deficiencies of the cover. It is a great story and beautifully illustrated. I think it's a top-notch book.
Agreed. And
good choices, gentlemen.
Good choice, Scott. He picked both books. But I hope we did justice to, the tip of the iceberg of the career of a guy who has been around our whole lives, and has quite possibly drawn more issues of comic books than anyone else, as far as the number that I've read. He's probably drawn more issues that I've read than anybody else has, and that's acknowledging I've read a tremendous number of books that Jack Kirby drew, and a tremendous number that John Romita drew. I think Sal Buscema, or a tremendous number that John Buscema drew. But I think Sal Buscema probably drew more books that I've been exposed to in my life than anyone else. So rest easy, and thank you for what you brought to our lives.
Amen.
All right, guys. On that note, I'm going to call an end to our discussion for tonight. But thank you for joining me to do this. I'm thrilled that we had Dr. Bill back with us, and I'm looking forward to having more Dr. Bill. It's almost like more cowbell, more Dr. Bill. So, bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiManzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.